This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The head of the Bloomington Normal NAACP says hospitals in particular need diversity and inclusion departments because minorities are often disenfranchised.
If a hospital staff is not familiar or accustomed with dealing with minority patients, that relationship is not as solid as it needs to be when it comes to healthcare.
Carla Campbell Jackson says this would help minimize biases. Plus, the city of Bloomington will get a lot of money back from former Coliseum operator John Butler, and Butler has pled guilty to theft. And Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington drops by. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. Beginning tomorrow, restaurant and bar patrons must wear a mask when interacting with servers and bartenders. This includes when employees take orders and bring food and drinks to the table and when customers pick up takeout orders. Illinois Department of Public Health Director Dr. Ngozi Ezike says those who think wearing a face covering is ineffective is in stopping the spread of COVID are wrong.
It doesn't matter what video you saw on the internet or the fake headline you read, please know that face coverings do save lives, but they must be used in conjunction with social distancing and hand washing.
Illinois has had a mask mandate since May 1st. The new rule specifically addresses interactions at bars and restaurants, which public health officials say is responsible for some of the recent disease spread. The new rule comes as two regions in the state face tougher restrictions due to the rising number of COVID-19 cases. On Tuesday, more than 1,600 people tested positive for the disease. 29 died. McLean County COVID testing positivity rate rose to 7.4% today as the county announced 43 new coronavirus cases. The rate is higher than regional and state averages. Most of those cases involve people ages 18 to 29. The November election campaign season is just ramping up, but some candidates are already looking ahead to next year's municipal contests. Attorney A.J. Zimmerman says he's running for Normal Town Council. In announcing his candidacy, Zimmerman says the town has the opportunity to expand collaboration and effectiveness and to avoid divisive rhetoric that is becoming more prevalent at all levels of government. Zimmerman currently heads the Normal Planning Commission. Three seats on the council are up for election next year. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Nearly 3 years after being indicted, the lead defendant in the Coliseum fraud case has agreed to pay more than $430,000 in restitution to the city of Bloomington after pleading guilty to a single misdemeanor theft charge. Ryan Denham was in court today and has this report.
John Butler will serve a 3-month jail sentence under home confinement with an ankle bracelet. As part of the plea agreement, prosecutors dismissed the 34 remaining criminal counts against Butler that, if convicted, would have sent him to prison for decades. Butler spoke to the media after the plea hearing.
4 years is long enough. Now it's time to move on.
The plea means the end is near for one of the most complex white-collar criminal cases in McLean County history. Butler and four co-defendants were accused of taking advantage of lax city oversight of the arena to steal hundreds of thousands of dollars over about a decade. Initially, Butler faced 44 criminal counts. On Tuesday, he left the courthouse guilty of only one misdemeanor. His concessions company, BMI, pleaded guilty to one count of felony theft. Addressing the media, Butler said he poured his heart and soul into managing the Coliseum from 2006 to 2016. He says his only regret is that the city should have treated the situation as a civil dispute and not a criminal matter. He pointed the finger at two former employees who have pleaded guilty themselves in the case as the ones who stole the money.
And in pleading to a misdemeanor charge, I'm doing so not because I personally took money from the Coliseum, but I should have known. I should have known that these individuals were taking money from the Coliseum. The buck stops with me, and ultimately I owe the duty to the taxpayers, and I drop the ball.
Butler must pay $430,000 in restitution to the city and another $20,000 to the Illinois Department of Revenue. It's due immediately. I asked his attorney, Steve Beckett, how he's able to pay that.
I would say that he is from a family that supported him and would help him meet that obligation.
Butler was indicted in 2017 by then McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers, who is now a judge. Current State's Attorney Don Knapp said the plea agreement means Butler is now a convicted thief. He says Butler admitted to criminal culpability and acknowledged the state could prove he stole a significant amount of taxpayer assets. Prosecutor Brad Rigdon addressed the media after the plea hearing.
When we end up in a situation where there is $450,000 in upfront payment coming to the direction of the taxpayers, as opposed to a situation where there may be nothing coming their direction, and a situation where even if ordered, there may still be nothing coming their direction. So this has benefit to the citizens of Bloomington, the citizens of McLean County, as this is money that is coming directly back to them.
Butler and the four other defendants were indicted in September of 2017 following a 16-month state police investigation that began when a new arena management company noticed financial discrepancies and alerted the city. Butler's two guilty pleas relate only to cash skimming, allegedly done by two of Butler's employees at his direction. About $102,000 in BMI's cash, all from concession sales, was taken between 2013 and 16. That meant the city never got its commission from those sales. It's about $14,000. Other charges against Butler, including wire fraud and tax evasion, were all dismissed. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner was pleased with the resolution of the case.
Sometimes justice does prevail.
But Renner was skeptical that $430,000 was all that was taken from the city.
Given the fact that we were defrauded by probably much more than that, and we will probably never really know, that's just the tip of the iceberg, I'm sure.
Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason was not hired until after Butler was already gone from the downtown arena. In a statement, Gleason said the agreement yielded a significant financial recovery. He also stressed that his city has since put in new oversight practices and procedures. That includes hiring a contract administrator whose duties specifically include overseeing arena management and conducting monthly reviews of arena finances. Butler was about to go on trial 2 weeks ago. Jury selection had even begun. But then the proceedings were abruptly halted. That suggested a plea deal was near. That scuttled trial also kept off the witness stand any former Bloomington officials who would have had to explain the city's lax oversight of arena finances. It also saved lawyers from having to clearly explain such a complex, high-profile case to jurors. State's Attorney Don Knapp acknowledged the odd timing of the plea agreement. He said Butler changed course and became willing to accept personal criminal culpability. Butler's attorney, Steve Beckett, describes what changed.
The state's attorney's office would have nothing to do with us until after the first day of trial, when we had a lengthy day of jury selection. And you could see in that jury selection, some of you were there, that the animus about this arena was still there, still out there in the community, which gave me great concern about whether or not we could really get a fair trial. So my advice to John was to accept this plea negotiation.
The settlement will also resolve civil claims between Butler and the city of Bloomington. Butler sued the city a few months after being charged. He claimed he was owed $67,000 in unpaid commissions. The city countersued, accusing him of breaching contract, civil conspiracy, and breach of fiduciary duty. The Bloomington City Council voted last night to authorize dismissing those claims. Former Arena Concessions General Manager Paul Grazer and former Concessions Finance Chief Jay Lash have already pleaded guilty and were expected to testify at Butler's trial. Charges against former Assistant GM for Finance Kelly Klein were dismissed. Charges are still pending, though, against former Coliseum GM Bart Rogers. It's unclear what Tuesday's developments mean for him. A message left with his attorney, Stephanie Wong, was not immediately returned. I'm Ryan Denham.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. After the Coliseum plea hearing today, John Butler's attorneys Steve Beckett and Tristan Bullington sat down with WGLT's Ryan Denham for an exclusive interview about the case.
I think you see, if you walk through the indictment, that we literally had a defense to everything. And so then you go, well, then if you had a defense to everything, then why in the world did the guy plead guilty? Well, 44 felony counts. So maybe this case was overcharge a little bit. If we overcharge him, if we intimidate him, you know, maybe the guy will plead guilty. You know, as I said, once we found out that the guys were embezzling, then we knew there was going to be commissions that were due, and we knew there was going to be sales tax due. And so it was just a question of how much and what's the best way to reach an agreement on how much it was. And our position was, let's use the contract. Let's mediate. Let's negotiate. Let's arbitrate. That's why those provisions are there. But I think the city of Bloomington wanted to save some legal fees. So they decided that they'd bring in the state police and they'd try to coerce John, to say uncle.
What happened? I've never seen a trial get called off, day two of jury selection. What happened? What changed on the ground between the parties that led to an actual agreement when 3 years passed without one?
I can't explain it. The state's attorney's office had some sort of change of heart. That's all the thing I can say. The corporate plea was always on the table, and the suggestion was made, you know, how about a corporate plea and a misdemeanor for the defendant? Oh, really? Make us an offer. So we made him an offer, and then it was just negotiations. And so I think you can see how significant the drop down from the 44 counts to a misdemeanor count is for John by the insistence, the absolute insistence that he have home confinement. We're talking about a guy from the community with no prior record who's done nothing but good for this community, and he must be in home confinement. So they had to have some sort of ounce of prevention or deterrence. You know, they wanted to show how tough the prosecution was, and so the guy has to go to jail. Well, he's not going to go to jail. He's 60 years old, for goodness sakes, and he's got hypertension. In COVID-19 terms, we're going to put this guy in jail. It made absolutely no sense. So we negotiated home confinement.
Lack of specificity was an issue throughout, not just John Butler's proceedings, but the other cases as well. I mean, vague charges being thrown out at different points. So what does that lack of specificity tell you about the case big picture, that the state struggled so much with narrowing in on the actual wrongdoing?
I think that's one of the problems with bringing a case with complex charges, is that ultimately what you have to remember is that you're going to try this case to a jury of lay people, and it better be simple. It better be something that the common, ordinary citizen can understand. We're not going to have 12 accountants on the jury. We're going to have people from all walks of life, many of whom don't understand that deep financial stuff. And so you ought to be careful. But once you bring broad charges like this, then you see the morass that you've created and the morass of evidence that you have to use to try to prove it. You know, the jury instructions that we prepared were like this thick. And you were there when the judge read the indictment to the prospective jurors. Look how long that took him to read that. It would have taken him half a day to read the jury instructions. And then we would have expected the jury to go back and deliberate, you know, after 3 weeks of evidence, you know, with us worrying about this hidden animus about the arena. It would be it's just a very, very, very tough call. And so, you know, the question really is for the prosecutors, why did you think you had to make the case that complex? Why not make it simple? Why not pick your strongest counts and charge those counts?
So the restitution is, $450,000 thereabouts, mostly to the city?
I guess our thought was that's kind of a premium. So, you know, to get a misdemeanor, John had to pay more than I really think. I was more in the $260,000 to $300,000 once we were done with the accountants of the potential arguments. Now, you know, if everything didn't go our way on 6.4, which is the concessions liability for commissions, mm-hmm. If that didn't go our way on the third-party vendors, the combo meals, then that's the kind of restitution that I thought that we would be facing. And if it had been arbitrated, I think that's the kind of money that he would have been facing. So he probably paid $100,000 or so more than he should have had to pay. But, you know, good for the state. They got something out of this. And I've always thought that this case was about the money.
How does he have $450,000 just sitting around? How is he going to pay that?
I would say that he is from a family that supported him and would help him. meet that obligation.
There's a tendency in the public to rush to judgment about people when you see 44 counts or 111 counts against five of them all total. There's a tendency to rush to judgment and to presume guilt. What is your message to the public about the next time this happens?
When an investigation is done, the investigation is marshaling sufficient evidence to be able to bring a charge, but that's not the rest of the story. I've never seen the police investigate to try to determine the defendant's innocence. In this case, John was a marked man. They wanted a scapegoat. John Butler was their scapegoat. He was the big kahuna. He got the 44 counts. But the best example I can give you is Kelly Klein. She is absolutely innocent. She should never have been charged. She was a bookkeeper doing her job. So it just made absolutely no sense for her to be charged. And to the same extent, I think Bart Rogers falls in that arena too. Although, because he's a manager and he has a car and he has this and he has that, he's a little more attractive as a defendant, I think, for the prosecutors. But in my view, from all the evidence I know, Bart is absolutely innocent as well.
That's John Butler's attorney, Steve Beckett, speaking with Ryan Denham. You can see more documents from the case, including the plea agreement and statements from prosecutors and Butler himself, at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As Illinois expanded its rules requiring masks while dining indoors, some are wondering whether municipalities like Bloomington or Normal need to take actions of their own to slow down the spread of COVID. A potential Bloomington City mask ordinance was discussed at last night's City Council meeting. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner tells Ryan Denham the recent surge in McLean County cases isn't surprising given the return of Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan University students.
That doesn't mean that we're not troubled by it. It just means that it's not terribly shocking that that's occurred. So we need to be as diligent as possible in moving forward. Now, we do know that there are guidelines for social distancing, and there's some discussion of possibly having a mask ordinance. I don't know how that would differ from our current practice, which is to just remind people and nudge people to do the right thing. But we will certainly see. We are going to do whatever we can to try to protect public safety and public health.
Mayor Renner, about a week ago, you sent a letter to bars and restaurants in your city, essentially reminding them that they have to enforce the state's mask requirements and capacity limits. And if they don't, they could be in jeopardy of losing their liquor licenses. What sort of response have you got to that letter up to this point?
Largely, it was positive. Now, until this weekend, where a couple of weeks ago, I had been in a local establishment in Bloomington. And I did I didn't put my mask back on when I got up to dance for like 3 minutes. And so the people who really don't like this use that as an opportunity or seize that as an opportunity to try to shove back. But not putting your mask back on for a 3 minute dance is not the same as having 100 or more people packed together like sardines in an institution and an establishment. So will I blink or hesitate to fine people because I should have put a mask back on? No way, right? I may have made a mistake as an individual. The greater threat to public health and to our community is when you have 100, 150 people packed tightly together and you're actually violating the law.
Champaign-Urbana, just to our east, has been a little bit more aggressive on this. Champaign has temporarily banned indoor service at campus town bars and restaurants. Urbana says you got to be seated if you're in a bar or restaurant, and it's limiting access to those under 21 after a certain time, I think 9 o'clock. Given that your downtown here in Bloomington is popular with young people, college students, have you considered ideas like that here?
Now, Champaign County, which is about the size of McLean County, has had, until the last few days, over three times the number of incidents of COVID that we have. So it's understandable that they're reacting in the way that they did. We're starting to see a spike. If this does not level off, from my perspective, all options have to be on the table for what we do moving forward.
What options would you be likely to consider first?
One is a mask ordinance that I initially, and I'm still somewhat unsure about that. I'm not clear as to how that would differ from our current practices. Under our current practices, we just remind people, hey, you know, there's too many people gathering together, or you really ought to practice social distancing, or please put your mask back on, or something like that. So I don't know what an ordinance would actually look like. And that's part of what we would have to discuss with the Bloomington City Council. I would prefer an ordinance where we're just reminding people rather than sort of box checking, so it seems like that we're snotty little bureaucrats.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner speaking with Ryan Denham. The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their council meetings. In 2 weeks, hear from Normal Mayor Chris Coos. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington Normal branch of the NAACP has been working on its new strategic action plan for months before George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis changed everything. His death provided even more impetus to get it done. The NAACP has unveiled its new action plan outside Mount Pisgah Baptist Church on Bloomington's west side. WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson was there and spoke with NAACP Vice President Carla Campbell Jackson about what's in the plan.
But as an organization, we recognize the disparities that African Americans often face and contend with. So we just felt compelled to make sure we come up with a plan to hold all of our constituents and all of the entities truly accountable. Because when they know they're being held accountable, they have a greater propensity to adhere to the demands and the requests that have been put forward.
Now, one of your demands is that hospitals require a diversity and inclusion department. Why was that significant to you all?
When it comes to health care and disparities, we know that unfortunately minority group members are often disenfranchised. So if a hospital staff is not familiar or accustomed with dealing with minority patients, that relationship is not as solid as it needs to be when it comes to health care. Conversely, if they are engaged in diversity and inclusion training, then they will be a lot more likely to build those bonds in hope of making sure the person becomes better, because that's the ultimate goal of anyone who enters into a hospital. They want to be made sure that they're feeling better mentally, physically, and socially. So we certainly think engaging in that type of training will be beneficial for our hospital staff. Research has shown that there is something associated with medical biases. So this would definitely help to minimize those biases.
How does COVID-19 play a role in the strategic plan? Does it have any influence on why you all feel it's important to have a diversity department in hospitals?
Certainly it has, and I think after listening to many reports from the CDC, we know that oftentimes doctors in hospitals would have to decide who gets a ventilator, and what a sad posture to be in, but they might have to decide which person in their perspective, from their perspective, warrants to live another 5-10 years. Well, if the playing field is leveled, then everyone would be allowed that equal opportunity. That's what it's all about, equality and doing what's right for the community. So certainly COVID-19 has played a critical role, because we've seen how that has disproportionately impacted people of color.
A portion of the recommendations you all have were provided by the Normal Community West Black Student Union. What was your experience like listening to what they wanted?
I am so energized and so proud of the students associated with the Normal Community West BSU. Everyone from Miss Jasmine and I believe another young man, Mr. Justin Turner, they've both done phenomenal jobs of bringing these issues to the forefront. And it was most amazing, because it's one thing for the school system to hear it from the NAACP because they're familiar with our platform, but to hear those same issues from students that are within their four walls absolutely indicates that there are problems that need to be addressed. There are racial and discriminatory problems that must be addressed head on. So I was very proud of those students. Not at all surprised, because we know a lot of this, but those students live it day in and day out, and they have the right to a quality education that's equitable in all sense of the word.
As far as education, you all said you wanted schools to recruit and hire beyond the local and in-state level. You said a way to do this is by hiring students who are graduates of historically Black colleges and universities. Why do do you feel this will be effective?
It's important to make sure that students are learning from a diverse staff. Research has also shown that students learn best when they can relate to their teachers, and teachers teach best when they have that solid relationship with the students. So making sure that we have that diversity is critical. Some will say, well, we're in the middle of Central Illinois and we can't find the diversity here. If that's the case, I challenge the school systems to go outside of Bloomington Normal to do whatever it takes. Take some unconventional measures to make sure that we are bringing that needed, that necessary diversity here to Bloomington Normal.
So do you all plan to work with other civil rights organizations to accomplish your goals? Would it be more effective if Black Lives Matter and NAACP spoke with one voice, or at least found two common action items to pursue together? Or what way do you all see that?
We are very proud of our Black Lives Matter movement, and we are certainly allies with them. We've supported them with many of the rallies that they've held. We have been there to support them because some of the same basic foundational items are very consistent. They want some of the same goals that we're aiming for as well. So certainly there is no opposition there. Of course, we all have our own different platforms, but ultimately we're all in this together, and we welcome the collaboration. Every event that we have, they're more than welcome to attend, and we've certainly been there to support their efforts as well. So it is not adversarial at all, and I don't want anyone in the community to think that, because we respect them, just different measures of achieving the same goals.
That's NAACP Vice President Carla Campbell-Jackson speaking with WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson. The NAACP plans to make its new strategic plan available online later this week. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham and student reporter Tiffany Jackson. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.